Good evening. This year is dedicated in memory of Yosef Hirsch, Zichrona Livracha, student at Yeshivat HaMiftar, who met his untimely death here in Jerusalem. Yosef was unique in that he always knew that what he wanted to do was to work for Klal Yisrael. He did this in Europe, and he was going to continue doing that after he left the yeshiva. Over the course of time, his family and myself have become very close, and it's actually an honor for me to give this shiur in his memory.
So, on the day of Lag BaOmer, certain ideas coalesced for the Jews. First of all, the Gemara says that the students of Rabbi Akiva stopped dying on Lag BaOmer. Either they stopped entirely or they stopped little by little. It was something that happened that remains unclear. It was, we could not call it history in our sense of things. But there's this general idea that there was a tragedy, a great tragedy. And that tragedy abated after Lag BaOmer in some ways. As a result of which, you know, there are different minhagim that Jews practice, minhagei avelut, during the days of Sfirah. Some of them, some people, it's the first days, and some people it's the last days, before Rosh Chodesh, after Rosh Chodesh. It's sort of like a grab bag of minhagim on for the avelut of the death of the students of Rabbi Akiva at this time. And you know that Bar Kokhba, Rabbi Akiva, I mean, if you don't know these stories, it's interesting. They're very interesting. Even though we don't have a complete rendition of any of these stories, but we know a little bit about it. We know that Rabbi Akiva was a great supporter of Bar Kokhba. And he actually thought that Bar Kokhba was the Messiah. And the Rambam quotes the story that when Rabbi Akiva saw Bar Kokhba, he carried his stuff for him. He was like Bar Kokhba's Batman. That's how highly Rabbi Akiva regarded Bar Kokhba. He thought he was a messianic personality. I don't make any connections to other messianic personalities in our time. I wanted to, after Shira, I'll talk to you for a minute. Okay. So here you have these that you know that Rabbi Akiva, the way I know Rabbi Akiva, I mean, I don't know him that well, and I don't know any real biography. I mean, you can't write a biography of Tanaim, really.
Right.
You could just sort of like attack them from different points of view.
But you're a big one.
Yeah. True. Rabbi Akiva was a misnagid. You know what a misnagid is? A misnagid values the text and is not interested in emotional outbursts. You know, that's like the joke they say. You know, that in the Gilat Esther, a couple of psukim are read with the nigun of Eicha. So if you ask the Misnagid, why do you read the with the Nigun of Eicha, he'll say, well, you know, that really makes my day. That, you know, Purim is such a silly time, I could turn it into a serious matter. So he says, why don't you read the whole Megillat Eicha in the melody of Eicha? So the Misnagid says, how much joy can we put up with? So that's a misnagid. That's what a misnagid is. A person who values unhappiness. So you know Rabbi Akiva was the ultimate misnagid. He's the man who struggled, like he worked hard. He started when he was 40 years old. He had help from his wife, who was the daughter of a rich man who disowned her because she married Rabbi. I mean, he's like really like a magazine. You could like sit there, and there's the story of Rabbi Akiva. He was a misnagid. Now he had a talmid. The Pirkei Avot says one of his talmidim was Rav Shimon ben Yochai. Now in the course of time, Rav Shimon ben Yochai, his birthday, his death day, his teaching day, his everything is all wrapped around Lag BaOmer. Now everything happened to him on Lag BaOmer, on the day of Lag BaOmer, so that in Tzfat and in other places where Kabbalah became to, you know, had a really strong position, so Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai was extolled. And for some reason, I think now my knowledge of the history of this is weak, but of the ideas I think are correct. Somehow they started making fires on his yard site. Because he was a light, you know, it's like not so hard to make a short parable about why Rav Shimon Yochai goes with fires. Now, in the 19th century, we're skipping a few days here because Rav Shimon ben Yochai was around the year 200, 250, and then who came after that? Rav Yosef Karo was the 16th century. I don't know the exact dates. It was the 16th century, right? And the Arizal was in Tzfat at the same time. It was like Rav Yosef Karo was sort of a Talmud of the Arizal. And then, of course, you get to the Baal Shem Tov and to the 19th century in Tzfat. And the 19th century in Tzfat, some person, I'm not so doing such a good job today, the 19th century, there's a man whose name I forgot, who decided to donate a Sefer Torah to the new shul that was built on the kever of Rav Shimon ben Yochai. Right? You know, 10 Jews, they get together. What are they going to do? They'll build another shul.
Mishpachat Abu.
Ech?
Abu.
Yes, he's right. Abu, that was their name. The family name. And this story is written up in all kinds of places. It's not hard to find. So he built a Beit Knesset. And in the kever of Rav Shimon bar Yochai, there was nothing there. And he built a Beit Knesset. And he, to inaugurate the Beit Knesset, he had a Hachnasat Sefer Torah on Lag BaOmer because it was the death of Rav Shimon ben Yochai. And they marched from Tzfat to Meron. If you've ever been there, ever done this, there's a very easy walk. It's like it's a bit of a walk, but it's an easy walk. It's not, you know, you don't have to climb up or climb down. You just walk. It's on more or less on the same level, and you get to Meron. He did this every year that he was alive, and it passed out into his family. Then that came to an end, and Bimikre, some relative of the Rebbe, which Rebbe is it? Not Rizin, but which Rebbe lights the bonfire tonight?
With a B.
Boyan. Hey, good, great. The Rebbe Boyan. No, the Boyan Rebbe. You should know the Boyan Rebbe because he's an American. So, like, Americans should have, like, special connection to him. He's an interesting person. You know, he grew up regular, as they say. Like, you know, he was like modern Orthodox, I would say. And he was the next in line. There was nothing he could do. You know, those Hasidim, they don't let go. So he became the Rebbe. And since he became the Rebbe, he's very highly regarded as a serious personality. A lot of people go to see him and talk to him. And I remember I was in America someplace and I met his sister, who was really modern Orthodox, whatever that means to you. I mean, I know what it means to me. she was like really, you know, like, so I said to her, do you talk to your brother? She says, all the time. I said, wow, that's really terrific. You have like an in-house Rebbe. Like you could always get through. So the Boyana Rebbe lights the Medura tonight, 8:30. He's there to light the Medura. So his great grandfather bought the Chazoka from the Abu family, who had lost interest in this, and probably he paid him a couple of farthings, but this great-grandfather must have realized that this would be a public relations coup, she'enkemoto, right? So look what happened. Look what happened, created out of nothing. They expect 350,000 people to go to watch the Boyana Rebbe light a fire in Meron. I mean, it defies belief. It absolutely defies belief. And since it defies belief, I'm sure that they're going to do this forever. And it's already called a chag. Chag, it's like Purim, like Hanukkah. So far the misnagdim are holding out. You won't see any great misnagid or rabbi, or even second class rabbi, unless they can really do it and not be noticed. But the yeshiva guys, they do go. They sneak away. They get on one of those buses, and they're gone. There's no way you can get out of there once you get in. You know, it's like so. I think that you can't get even near. You know, you get to Afula, you might as well park. The whole thing is really—it's beyond. It goes beyond belief. It's bigger than Purim. It's certainly bigger than Hanukkah. I mean, Hanukkah is today is no big deal, but it's bigger than Purim, which is a holiday that people celebrate in the street. The biggest thing that ever happened in Israel, and further amazement is that, of course, it's an Israeli holiday. It's a holiday that Israelis, nobody else separated and celebrated. I remember, the Zionists tried to make Lag BaOmer into Yom Sport. I remember in Bnei Akiva, when I was a kid, we used to have a Lag BaOmer. We used to have go to some stadium, and they would race and talk and run three-legged races and potato, whatever it is. They do it all day. And it started in Europe. It started in Europe, in Germany, and Poland. They did this. You know, Germany, they called them, the scouts were called Wandervogel. You know, which I don't know if that means scouts, but it's like wandering birds, you know, like... Anyway, it's really very interesting. Now, I am for years opposed to Lag BaOmer. It's the fires are no good. It's bad for the health. Kids, children were killed on Lag BaOmer climbing up that ridiculous pole. It has a name. What is it called? Because you can do two for two, Miriam. What is it called, that pole they put in the middle? You know what?
In Meron.
No, everybody, when you build a fire and you want it to go up, by Boy Scout training, you want it to go up be high fire, so you have to get a pole, you put in the pole, and then you lean the wood against the pole, so you get a fire, not just a fire, but you get it up, going up to heaven. A klutz. That's what it's called. Is it called a klutz?
Yeah.
It's called, you ask a kid. It's a kid in Israel. He doesn't know what it is. He says, Yesh lecha klutz, Yesh lecha eitz leklutz. That's how they talk. That's how they all do this, so they have to climb up on the klutz in order to get the wood piled very high. So of course some other teenage vandal, you know, lights the fire when the kid is on the top. That's what happened in my neighborhood where I live. A kid was killed. Was killed in that way. They were just roasted. Yeah. And it doesn't matter. Nothing will stop them. Nothing. And they'll just... They keep doing that.
We don't have a key.
What is that?
Let's go down.
It's downstairs.
No, it was a pleasant distraction. Now, so I've been against, I was always against Lag BaOmer, and I thought that the Shulchan Aruch was right, that it's enough not to say Tachnon, it's a great solution. And of course, since I noticed that the more I'm against it, the more my grandchildren seem to be there, I figured that this is going to win, that Lag BaOmer is going to win. I was on a plane after the Shavuot, after Lag BaOmer, and one side of me said a Satmar Chosid. So I said, what are you doing here? Where are you going? He said, I'm going home. I live in Borough Park. I said, what do you do in Eretz Yisrael? I came for Lag BaOmer. So I said, Eretz Yisrael, you're Strafer, you're Sat Mechotzer. We're good. He said, Lag BaOmer. It's Mutter. It's Mutter to come to Eretz Yisrael on Lag BaOmer. I said, oh, okay. That was very, very, very interesting. So there, you see there's a futility in reasonableness. You can't beat it. Can't beat it. So now.
I have to tell you a story. I was in your yeshiva. I was going to skip out on Shir.
I didn't go though.
I was going to skip out on Shir to go to Maryland to Lag BaOmer. And I told you the day before, I won't be here tomorrow. I'm taking the bus up to Lag BaOmer. So Maryland just looked at me and said, don't eat the meat.
But you told me, because you wanted me to stop you, right?
Is the tradition of mourning during the Omer, is that equally unfounded?
Well, it's not unfounded. It's in the Gemara that this was a period of time of great tragedy. However, it's not clear when people adopted this minhag of mourning. It certainly wasn't after Rabbi Akiva died. And there are some people who say it's connected to the Crusades, that there was a lot of life-taking and wanton destruction during the Crusade era. And this period became more and more a time of minor kind of avelut because of that. I don't have an opinion. I'm not a historian, but that's what some people say. I mean, there's always a question, even if you have a reason for general kind of mourning, it's not so easy to get it established. Just because you think people should mourn doesn't mean that they're going to mourn. Right? They could say, we have that experience today in Israel, that, not everybody takes the secular holidays the same way. I'm not talking about Haredi people who are ideologically opposed. I'm talking about people in general who are not ideologically opposed. They don't react to these special days in the same way. They're different. They react differently. Some more into it and some not so much into it. That's what I wanted to say about Lag BaOmer. The second thing I wanted to say is really about the parasha. There are two things I want to say about the parasha. This is not on the sheet. And that is that the parasha mostly deals with the mitzvah of Shemitah. And the mitzvah of Shemitah, I mean, this is the Shemitah year, this year. So I think speaking about Shemitah is not a bad thing. The mitzvah of Shemitah is, to my mind, a little bit odd. Because it's a demand that we accept that God is in charge of the world in a very extreme manner. We do something that is going to destroy our ability to subsist unless we are supported by a miracle. What we do is we don't use the produce, we don't work the land or use the produce on year 7, and then we plant again on year 8, and then we can only eat on year 9, so that sometimes we actually don't have any produce for 3 years. And that is something that can't work. I mean, no farmer on his own would ever choose to take such an option. And so the Torah itself says that if you turn to God and say, what are we to do? How are we supposed to live? So the Torah says you have to follow the rules. And if you follow the rules, God will come and support you. It's the only mitzvah in the Torah that has that. When we say Shema, we say Vayan Shema Tishma'u. If you listen to the mitzvot, then the world will be supportive of your efforts. Meaning that it'll rain when it's supposed to rain, and it'll be dry when it's supposed to be dry. That's what will happen if you do the mitzvot. But only about Shemitah does it say that if you have faith, you will be able to live. And if you don't have faith, you simply will not be able you will not be able to live. Now, this is a very, very difficult mitzvah to keep, and there's an opinion in the Gemara that the Jews of old never really kept Shemitah. And the reason was that, I mean, we're not talking about people who are not quote-unquote religious, because people are not religious, so it's not interesting to say that they didn't keep Shemitah. But we're talking about people who are religious, so do the mitzvot. But Shemitah, they were unable to keep. Now, for a variety of reasons, in modernity, the question of Shemitah, I'm going to make a political statement now. Not heavy. I mean, the politicians are not doing so well, so I don't want to get involved with them. So in the same 16th century that we mentioned before, Rabbi Yosef Karo and Rabbi Shaya the Trani had a difference of opinion about the following question. Does Eretz Yisrael, in our time, does Eretz Yisrael have Kedusha? Does the land of Israel have Kedusha? Do things that are grown in the land of Israel have Kedushat Shvi'it? Even if we say that Shvi'itah Bizman Hazeh is only Drabanan. I mean, it's all very complicated. I'm trying to just get to the essence of it. So Rabbi Yosef Karo says that anything that was grown in Eretz Yisrael by a non-Jew does not have Kedushat Shvi'it. Rabbi Shai Detrani, the Mabit, he said no, it does have. So from the 16th century until now, we have generally accepted the Psak of the Beit Yosef, which is that anything that grown in Eretz Yisrael, in Arab-owned land, does not have Kedushat Shvi'it, and you could just eat it. You could just eat it so that every fruit store in Yerushalayim that has a hechsher of the badats, right, those guys, the fruit and vegetables in that store come either from Arabs in Eretz Yisrael or from Chutz Laaretz. And that really, there's no change, except that today, even today, because all that means is that Tnuva separates the things that are grown by Arabs from the things that are not grown by Arabs. They send the Arab stuff to Yerushalayim and to Bnei Brak and kindred spots. And that solves the problem. Now, during the 6 years, they also buy fruits and vegetables from Arabs, whether they're native Arabs or Arabs from, you know, or from Jordan, it's all the same. It's just that during the 6 years, they're not careful to separate this from that and that from this. Okay? So that's the generally held position in Eretz Israel. It was held since the time of the Beit Yosef until today. It was on that position that Rabbi Yitzchak Chanan was asked a question. Rabbi Yitzchak Chanan in Krakow. They said to him, we now have Haredi agriculture in Eretz Israel. Petach Tikva was started by Haredi Jews from Yerushalayim who went there and decided to be agriculturists. And so these few people, were the only people in the universe who were really affected by the question of Shemitah. Because in Yerushalayim, nobody worked. This is not a new thing in Yerushalayim that people don't work. This is a long-standing minhag. Nobody worked. So when they wanted to buy fruits and vegetables, they went to the Arab market, or at the, you know, Meir Shearim, there's a market. And they went there, not this one, but that one, it's called, what is it called? I don't know, Meir Shearim. They went to Meir Shearim, and that's why the old Jews in Yerushalayim all speak Arabic. They didn't learn it in Ulpan. And they didn't learn it at home. They learned Arabic in the shuk. That's where they learned how to speak Arabic, because they all bought all the time, all the years. There were no Jews who sold tomatoes. There were only Arabs who sold tomatoes, and they sold their brothers tomatoes. The brother grew it, and he sold it. Right? That's how it worked. So the only people who had a problem with Shemitah were this handful of Haredi agriculturists who were growing tomatoes and cucumbers on their fields. Well, whatever Jews were agriculturists from the first Aliyah, the second Aliyah, who worked the land, they couldn't care less. They couldn't care less. They didn't ask a shaila. They didn't go and send their shaila to Rabbi Yitzchok Chanan to find out what they should do, because they couldn't care about even the ones who had a background, who knew things, who understood, but they weren't interested in keeping law. So you only had these few people. So Rabbi Yitzchok Chanan said, they said to Rabbi Yitzchok Chanan, "We're going to die because we're not going to be able to support ourselves. We're out of the ring of the people who just take money because they exist and don't work. We're supposed to work. We're supposed to make our way. Who's going to give us money? Where do we get money from?" So on that basis, Rabbi Yitzchok Chanan and two other dayanim in Krakow said, "Heter mechira." Said heter mechira. It's problematic. It's not obvious. It's not something that. But they said that if you sell the land that you're working to a goy, it goes into that category. It's in the category of non-Jewish land, right? In the category of non-Jewish land, and so okay, with certain restrictions, you can eat the food, sell the food, buy the food, and you can live. When Rav Kook came on the scene, right, that was before World War I, Rav Kook came to Eretz Yisrael, became the Rav in Yafo. Rabbi Yitzchok Chanan had died. Rabbi Yitzchok Chanan, his heter, pointed out that this heter is only for now. That's the way he said it. But every 7 years, you have to review the situation. After all, he said, if they're going to die, and it's really pikuach nefesh, I will give the heter. But that means you have to check every 7 years to see what the economic situation is. Well, are you well off? Are you able to do this? Right, so when Rav Kook came on the scene, Rav Kook was asked the same question by the same people. They didn't ask him in Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim was organized. They didn't ask him in other religious neighborhoods. I don't know the word, Tveria. There were religious people in Tveria and Tzfat. Tveria, Tzfat, and Yerushalayim. Bnei Brak didn't really exist. And so Rav Kook wrote a very interesting, long, interesting commentary on Hilchot Shmita V'Yovel of the Rambam. And he wrote ideological considerations and theological considerations. Really a great work. He called it Shabbat Ha'aretz. A great halachic, ideological, poetic. It has all those elements in it. And he said, as Rabbi Yisrael Chanan said before him, okay, we'll sell the land. We'll sell their land, and they'll be able to live. But every Shemitah, you have to look into it again. Because he gave the heter for one time. You have to look into it. If you can avoid the heter mechira, you should, Rav Kook said. And that was one line. Then the Chazon Ish came to Eretz Yisrael. Right, the Rav Kook died in 1935. I think the Chazon Ish came in 1933. Came to Eretz Yisrael, and if he came to Eretz Yisrael and he left the Beit Din of Rav Chaim Ozer in Vilna, he must have had a very strong pull for Eretz Yisrael. I'm talking about the Chazon Ish, right? He must have really been a secret Zionist. Along comes the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish said, no, the Beit Yosef was wrong. The Mabit is right. And the land that's worked by Arabs, produces fruits and vegetables that have Kedushat Shvi'it, and you can't sell the land, your land, the Jewish land, to a goy. That's prohibited. There is a clear Isser in the Torah. Lo techanem. You can't give them, meaning the other nations of the world, a place in Eretz Yisrael. And he felt that that was an abomination, about which I'll tell you a story in a couple of minutes. He felt it was truly an abomination that the Jews would sell the land of Eretz Yisrael in order to avoid being frum. You know, and also in his time, the time of the Chazon Ish, how many people are we talking about? How many people cared about selling the land of Eretz Yisrael? So interestingly enough, since the Chazon Ish was seen as being the machmir, right, the Haredim trying to do in the Dati Lumi. So the Dati Lumi guys said we're going to adopt the Heter Mechira, even though there was no Heter Mechira except for those people who couldn't live without it. There was no Heter Mechira. Like if you lived in Yerushalayim, when I came to Yerushalayim, it was very hard to buy fruits and vegetables on Shemitah. But you could. I mean, it was possible if you wanted to go out of your way and buy fruits and vegetables that were grown by non-Jews, not the Heter Mechira non-Jews, but grown by non-Jews, you could do it. Today, in Yerushalayim, it's hard not to do it. I mean, the situation has changed so much that you go into a supermarket, you can get fruits and vegetables that have nothing to do with the Heter Mechira. They're either grown by Goyim, or they're grown by Arabs outside of Eretz Yisrael. Almost every place in Yerushalayim does that. So Chazon Ish said, no, you can't do that. And okay, so he had a different system how to deal with the problem, but even according to the Chazon Ish, of course, if you get fruits and vegetables from Jordan, as we often do, we, Eretz Yisrael, Tanuva, right, get fruits and vegetables from Jordan because we can't produce enough, like the consumers here like tomatoes and cucumbers. So if you can't, so for most people, even people who adopt the principles of the Chazon Ish, if they buy fruits and vegetables from Jordan or from some other country, from Spain or from Italy, right, we have a lot of that going on because we want to export. In order to export, sometimes you have to import. Sometimes you have to export and import the same thing in order to maintain. You know, that's called business. That's called business. You got to keep the money churning around. It's like if you have cucumbers and I have cucumbers, so there's some advantage in me selling you my cucumbers and you selling me your cucumbers, even though the bottom line might be zero. But it's still, we're like talking to each other, drinking coffee, sitting around, taking plane trips. Here and there, we were staying in hotels, like, that's all good. Good to have business, it's good to have expenses. Because you don't get taxed on expenses. So, that's called business. Whoever understands that can understand that. So again, the Chazon Ish made it more difficult. The Chazon Ish made it more difficult, but not really more difficult. Because in Eretz Yisrael, it's not a problem. It's not a problem to live according to the Chazon Ish. It's not like you have to go someplace to get fruits and vegetables. It's there. It's like all available. And more because of this, I think, I don't know the psychology of chumras, but the psychology is that people like chumras. As long as it doesn't bother them too much. You know, you want to be able to say to your friends, oh, we do this, we do that. How much matzah do you eat on the night of Pesach? You know, they got these kind of discussions that people seem to enjoy. So they enjoy being machmir. So a lot of yeshiva people have adopted the position of the Chazon Ish against the position of Heter Mechira. But I stress that there's really not such a great difference between these two positions. It's just that the Chazon Ish said you can't sell the land to an Arab because even if you could, it wouldn't help. Because fruits and vegetables grown in Israel on non-Jewish land still have Kedushat Shvi'it. So the whole process is irrelevant and doesn't make any sense. And anybody who chooses either path is going to be victorious. So somebody told me the following story, and with this I want to end the discussion of Shemitah. Somebody asked the Chazon Ish, and this is where I heard the story, I cannot validate it. I can only tell it over. You know, that's how good stories don't have sources. So somebody asked the Chazon Ish, why did you make so much trouble about Shemitah? I mean, like, it's only Drabbanan. There's a lot of ways to say that, you know, you don't have to be so machmir. So the Chazon Ish said this, reputedly to have said this. He says, there are two mitzvot in the Torah. And you have to tell me what they are. Two mitzvot in the Torah that affect our national character. They make national character, right? Sounds like a Zionist. He says, our nation, like, who are we? Who are we? Are we the nation of Israel because we eat a matzah and Pesach? No. Because we shake a lulav at Sukkot? No, he said there are two mitzvot. There are two mitzvot. One is the mitzvah of Shemitah, which is a mitzvah that affects the entire nation simultaneously. Everybody's affected. I mean, not today, but in theory, everybody's affected. Says the other mitzvah that affects the nation as a nation is the prohibition against usury, taking interest on a loan. He says, not taking interest on a loan distinguishes us. Now, of these two mitzvot, he, the Chazon Ish, said, one is lost. Like, we do take usury on the loan. We do it with a trick. We do it with a trick. It's called the Heter Iska. We sort of like make believe we are partners with the bank, and the bank makes a profit, and then we make part of that profit. And the bank just calls it interest. But it really, we say it's not. Okay, whatever. You know, that's something that's called a legal fiction, like, you know, I don't know, legal. I don't like to say legal fiction because it makes you think that it doesn't work, but it does work. It really works. That's when it comes to rebeat. But when it comes, so he says, I don't want to lose Shemitah. Now, I take that as being the answer to the question of why the Chazon Ish came to Eretz Yisrael. He was not a member of a Zionist youth group. He did not come to Eretz. He was like 50 when he came to Eretz Yisrael. He did not come to Eretz Yisrael because he had nothing to do in the diaspora. As I said, he was a member of the Beit Din of Rav Chaim Ozer in Vilna. And Rav Chaim Ozer was the titular head of the Haredi community in Europe, Western Europe and Eastern Europe. And the Chazon Ish was kind of his right-hand man. And, you know, but he decided, the Chazon Ish decided that the time had come, he had to go to Eretz Yisrael. And he felt, apparently, that Eretz Yisrael was the place where the Jews had to express their natural character, their national character. So when it came to interest, taking interest and giving interest, that was done way before his time. You know that there are certain Arab banks that don't take interest. You know, which is annoying. You know, that these Arab banks do manage to maintain the biblical standard, and we don't. Of course, they get the money in other ways, right? They take fees. We don't like fees. That's how they do it. But they do it. They're concerned about taking interest. So when you, and your credit card, when you buy things on your credit card, there's never an interest payment on the credit card, but there are fees that you have to pay, fixed fees that, according to Sharia law, are not considered to be interest. They do it, and we don't do it. So the Chazon Ish said, usury is gone. Interest, I mean, we pay interest, we can't do anything about that. But we have to save Shemitah. You have to save Shemitah. I think that sometimes it seems to me that we're saving Shemitah, but at the expense of it not affecting us. Because what happens in reality is that it's all the same, right? There's no difference between keeping Shemitah and not keeping Shemitah. So the Rabbanut ends up doing the Heter Mechira mostly for people who are totally not interested in mitzvot. It's sort of you offer them this merit. You say, I know you're not interested in Shemitah, but if you allow the Heter Mechira, maybe in heaven you'll get a better deal. But most religious people don't do it that way. It's true that in the Lumi world, there are some people who are ideologically committed to the Heter Mechira. They've kind of decided that that's what the real rabbis want, and that the imitation rabbis who look like old-fashioned people, they don't know what's really going on. But sometimes I think that they also, Wittman wrote a book on this question. Wittman, who is the chief rabbi of Tenuva. You know Tenuva? Mm-hmm. Not an insignificant company. Yeah. And in relation to all of these things. So Wittman, in the last Shemitah, like 8 years ago, put out a book on the ideological component of Shemitah, Eretz Yisrael, Zionism, you know, all that kind of stuff. But I think that it's misleading, because he doesn't say that during the 6 years, in other words, he doesn't like the idea of buying produce from enemies. And since all the Arabs are enemies, he doesn't like that. But okay, I can understand that, but he doesn't mention the fact that we buy produce from enemies all 6 years, all 7 years, not just on Shemitah. It's not like we buy produce from them to keep ourselves alive. We do it all the time, because we don't produce enough to feed ourselves. Because today, people don't want to work in agriculture. I don't know, there's plenty of land, because we're good at growing more out of less. Right? That's one of the great Israeli achievements. But we buy Arab produce all the time. Like I say, business is about churning up the waters. And so we're interested in churning up the waters with neighboring Arab states. Okay? Okay, that's the second thing I wanted to talk about today. The third thing I wanted to talk about, which I think, thankfully, I'm not going to be able to do very much of, is the first pasuk in our parasha. If you look at the sheet, the first pasuk says, "Vayedaber Hashem el Moshe b'har Sinai le'mor." Now we're at the end of Vayikra. Okay, so I take a deep breath. I really don't have to. I like to talk. So this pasuk comes at the end of Vayikra, right? The end of Shemot was about building the Mishkan. The beginning of Vayikra, the first two parashiyot, were about the korbanot that are going to be brought in that Mishkan that was just built. Then after that, there are some stories that have to do with the setting up of the Mishkan and in pointing Aaron as the Kohen Gadol in Shmini, and then Sukim about Kashrut, which animals you could eat, which animals you should not eat, and then more about Tumah Vatara in Tazria Mitzora, and then a parasha which is mostly about Kohanim, Emor, right? So you have Vayikra Tzav, Shmini, Tazria Mitzora, Achrei Mot Kedoshim. We have all those topics that somehow are connected. This is what the Ramban says in his introduction. They're somehow all connected to the Mishkan, assuming that we include Tumah V'Tahara, which is very much connected to Kohanim, right? And then Achremot, Kedoshim, about the death of the sons of Aaron, and Yom HaKippurim, and then Achremot, Kedoshim, Emor. Then more regulations about Kohanim. All of these things sort of belong in the same book. And then Bahar. And Bahar is a deviation, because Bahar is primarily about Shemitah. And Shemitah does not have anything specifically to do with Kohanim or with Tumah V'Tahara or with the Korbanot. It was all these topics that are primary in the book of Vayikra have nothing to do with Shemitah. And the parasha of Shemitah begins with this statement, Vayedaber Hashem al Moshe b'har Sinai lemor. And so we wonder, what is this reference? What do you mean God spoke to Moshe Rabbeinu b'har Sinai? If he spoke to Moshe Rabbeinu b'har Sinai, why didn't we learn about it earlier? Why didn't we learn about it? In fact, where was Shemitah originally mentioned but in one pasuk? In the parasha of Mishpatim. Now you remember Mishpatim? Shmot v'era bo b'shalach Yitro. Shmot v'era bo b'shalach. That's, what is that? That topic? Yitziat Mitzrayim, right? Yitro Mishpatim. Yitro Mishpatim is Matan Torah. Matan Torah. Mishpatim contains a pasuk about Shemitah. Right? Just, you should have Shemitah. Shmos v'era bo b'shalach. Yitziat Mitzrayim. Yitro Mishpatim, Kabbalat HaTorah. Remember that the Jews were taught Torah in the parasha of Mishpatim, possibly so that they could say Naseh v'Nishma on the Torah that they didn't know yet. It's as though Moshe Rabbeinu, directed by God, tells B'nai Yisrael, there's more where this came from, right? There's more. This is only just a bit. And so B'nai Yisrael said, as much as there is, we'll accept it. We accept what we know, and we will accept what we don't know. That's an important note. And then the parasha of Bahar, which comes after all these parashiyot of Vayikra that are connected somehow, directly or tangentially, to the building of the Mishkan. The story of Shemitah begins with this pasuk, where the Be'er Moshe Bahar Sinai Neimor. And so the question is, what is Bahar Sinai? Bahar Sinai, they did learn something about Shemitah in the parasha of Mishpatim. So what is this? How does this relate to Har Sinai? So Rashi says, Tualotel, Pratotel, V'diktukel, Mi Sinai. I'm sorry, I'm reading from the middle. Ma'anyan Shemitah, Eitzel Har Sinai. Now this, of course, is a famous aphorism that is used by Israelis very liberally, right? You can even hear it on the guys who read the news sometimes, or talk to newsworthy people, will say, Ma'anyan Shemitah Eitzel Har Sinai. It's a non-sequitur. It's a non-sequitur. But here it means, why specifically do we say that Shemitah was taught to Moshe Rabbeinu on Har Sinai? Wasn't everything taught to Moshe Rabbeinu on Har Sinai? That's what Rashi says. Halo kol ha-mitzvot ne'emru b'Sinai. So Rashi is teaching us a basic Jewish concept, that Torah is min ha-shamayim. Torah is min ha-shamayim. I call a mitzvot. I mean, it could be that Rashi is narrowing it. Because if you say to me, what was Moshe Rabbeinu doing on Har Sinai for 40 days and 40 nights? Right, the first time, the second time, what was he doing there? He was studying the Torah. What do you mean that he was studying the Torah? I'm talking to myself, right? What do you mean you're talking to that he was studying the Torah? Well, he was learning that part of the Torah that existed. What part of the Torah existed? Mitzvot. He studied the mitzvot. So God told him sukkah. God told him matzah. God told him tefillah, emunah, and all of the things that were there. What was not there? You could argue it. I'm not saying that you could not argue otherwise. But you could say that the story of Bilam was not there at Har Sinai. Because Bilam may not have been invented yet. We don't know anything about Bilam. Or you could say that somehow maybe God, I don't like that. I like to say that God taught Moshe Rabbeinu the timeless Torah. And the timeless Torah was the Torah of the mitzvot. Well, the Torah of the mitzvot and not the Torah of the stories. The stories eventually were given to Moshe Rabbeinu in Ohel Moed. When God dictated the Torah to Moshe Rabbeinu, which included all of the stories, but then by then they had happened. It wasn't like Moshe Rabbeinu learned the Torah of the stories before the stories actually took place. I don't like that. So that's what I would say. That's what I would say. So again, it says Elamash Mita Amro Klalotel Pratotel Digrebi Sinai Avkulan Amro Klalotel Digrebi Sinai. Just as Shemitah was taught to Moshe Rabbeinu at Sinai, Klalotel, Pratotel, all the dinim, all the rules, all the regulations, of which there are many, that are not stated clearly in the Torah, although Bahar is a very expanded version of the laws of Shemitah, but they're not, it's not like the laws of Shemitah. The laws of Shemitah were actually taught to Moshe Rabbeinu and Har Sinai. It's just that he taught it to Bnei Yisrael in the parasha of Bahar after all of this stuff. But Moshe Rabbeinu knew this. He may not have known how exactly the wording of the parashiyot is. That may have been told to Moshe Rabbeinu from Ol Moed. So, klalotehem upratotehem v'diktukeha misinai. That's what he said. So this you learn a general rule that if it's true about Shemitah, that even though Shemitah, the klal of Shemitah is in the parasha of Mishpatim, that was at Har Sinai, and the prat of Shemitah is here in Bahar. So we say that that's all the mitzvot. We generalize. We say, why did the Torah tell us this? Tell us Bahar Sinai. In order that we should understand that Moshe Rabbeinu studied everything that there was to study at Har Sinai, right? Af kulam nemru klalotem dignem Sinai, tashnu ya betorat kohanim. And so Rashi quotes, he says, this is the way it is presented to us in Torat Kohanim. Torat Kohanim is a halachic medrash of the book of Vayikra, and it has authority for Rashi. It's an authoritative source. It's like saying a Gemara. It's better than a Gemara. It's Tanaim. It's not a Moraim. Torat Kohanim. Another name for Torat Kohanim, Sifra. There are only three Medrashei Halacha in the universe. The Mechilta, which is on the end of Shemot. The Sifra, / Torat Kohanim on Vayikra. And the Sifri, which means Sfarim. Two books, Bamidbar and Dvarim. Those are the three halachic medrashim. There are only three. The difference between a medrash and a difference between the medrash and a mishnah, both of which were written by Tanaim, is that the medrash explains the psukim, and the mishnah lists the halacha. Now sometimes the mishnah also quotes a pasuk, but that's not its basic format. The basic format of a Mishnah is halacha, halacha, halacha. That's a Mishnah. And that's why the Mishnah was chosen, because the Mishnah is topical. Whereas if you go according to the Psukim, you go from one topic to another topic to a third topic, it's a little bit. But apparently they had these two ways of learning. In the time of the Tanaim, there were two ways of learning. They either learned halachot, groups of halachot, that tried to figure out what they were about, or they learned groups of psukim and tried to understand what the psukim say. Kach shnuya b'torat kohanim v'nir eli, Rashi says. Nir eli, and this Rashi causes a lot of problems. Shekach perusha. This seems to me that this is the primary interpretation of this pasuk. When you say Bahar Sinai, Lemor, you mean it was all taught to Moshe Rabbeinu at Har Sinai. What was all? The klalim and the pratim. There is a sukkah, and this is how you make it. Right? There's a klal, and there's a prat. But they're all part of the Matan Torah that Moshe Rabbeinu was responsible for. Nir Eli Shekach Perusha Lefi Shelo Batsinu Shmitat Karkaot Shenishneit Ba'arvot Bo'av B'Mishnei Torah. After all, there is no mention of Shmitat Karkaot, of what we call Shmitah in Dvarim, right? Arvot Mo'av. is where the book of Dvarim is set. It refers to Arvot Moab, and you know a lot of things are repeated in the book of Dvarim, even though the Rabban points out in his introduction that many things are not repeated. There are also halachot that we learn in the book of Dvarim that we didn't know about at all. Many places. Just some things are repeated. Arvot Moab, the Mishneh Torah. Mishneh Torah is a synonym for Dvarim. Mishneh Torah, Lamad Shukalotel Pratotel Kulab Debumi Sinai. Uba Katub Lamad Khan Al Kodi Bur Shenidbal Moshe Mi Sinai Hanyu Kulab. Okay, that's a little confusing, and it's not easy to understand. The Ramban has a long digression about this, but what Rashi is telling us, and what is generally accepted as being the Jewish position until modern times, was that Moshe Rabbeinu learned the klalim, general, and the pratim, the specific details, about these halachot at Har Sinai. Now this question is restated in the Gemara in several places. One of them in Zvachim. Right, one of them in Zvachim. I'll just go through this again. Rabbi Yishmael Omer. You see the second source? Rabbi Yishmael Omer Klalot Nehemu B'Sinai U'Pratot Be'Ohel Moed. Rabbi Ishmael disagrees with Rashi, or Rashi disagrees with Rabbi Ishmael. According to Rabbi Ishmael, the general rules were stated at Har Sinai, but the details were taught to Moshe Rabbeinu and to Bnei Yisrael. The details were taught Be'ohel Moed. After they built the Mishkan, God would call to Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu would go in and study the next section of the Torah and come out and teach it to the people. Rabbi Akiva, however, Omer, Kralot uPratot Nehemru B'Sinai, V'Nishnu B'Ol Mo'ei, V'Nishtalshu B'Arvot Mo'av. So according to Rabbi Akiva, and according to Rabbi Yishmael, apparently, there were different sources or locations for the Torah, except that the Rabbi Akiva calls them Nishnu. They were repeated. The Torah was taught to Moshe Rabbeinu and Har Sinai in its complete form. It was then repeated to Moshe Rabbeinu in Ohel Moed, and taught again to Moshe Rabbeinu in Avot Moav, the book of Dvarim. Now it may be
taught
that...
Again two Moshe.
What?
Taught again to Moshe Rabbeinu. There was another revelation in Avot Moav.
Where was? Wait a minute. Another what?
I'm just.
Ohel Moed. There was another revelation.
Right.
That's for sure.
Right. So Shuber, but Moav, who's teaching whom?
No, God was teaching Moshe Rabbeinu again, but it just doesn't appear entirely in the book of Dvarim. It was there. It was there, but so there were two revelations in Arvot Moav. So Il Moshe Be'er et Torah. So that's more expansive, even more than we knew before. And there are certain parshiyot in Dvarim that fit into that category. What exactly happened in that? I mean, I don't know. I'm not trying to fool you. I just don't know.
Yeah.
I've thought about this for many years. But I think that what it means is, everybody agrees that in some way the giving of the Torah to Bnei Yisrael was a longer project than the 40 days that Moshe Rabbeinu was at Har Sinai. And whether Moshe Rabbeinu knew it all when he taught it to start teaching to Bnei Israel, or he was actually had to learn it over again as God spoke to him from the Mishkan, from the Ohel Moed in the Mishkan, that, you know, we can argue about. I just want to point out that this pasuk, Vayedaber Hashem Moshe b'Har Sinai Lemor, seems to state clearly that Moshe Rabbeinu learned whatever he learned, including the Shemitah V'Yovel, in Har Sinai. I wanted to tell you, I mean, we're not going to do it now, but you could do it on your own if you want. This pasuk, Vayikra Perek Zayin, Asher Tzivah Hashem et Moshe v'Har Sinai, B'yom tzavoto et b'nei Yisrael lakir eto b'neihem l'ashem b'midbar Sinai. Again, the first phrase is, we're talking about material, we're talking about korbanot. Right? This is Vayikra Perek Zayin. Perek Zayin is Tzav. Vayikra and Tzav are the parshiot of korbanot. So this pasuk says that God commanded Moshe b'Har Sinai. But they weren't at Har Sinai. They were certainly not at Har Sinai. So the Ramban goes at great length to try to explain that Har Sinai could mean any place in Midbar Sinai, could also be called Har Sinai. So that according to the Ramban, he changes Rabbi Akiva's statement and said, there were three locations. There's Har Sinai, and there's Ol Moed, and then there's Arvot Moab. So he says Har Sinai and Ol Moed are the same. Because as long as the Jews were wandering around the desert, you could call that place Har Sinai. Like it's often true. You name, if you go to Mount Everest or something, you don't be on top of the mountain to be at Mount Everest. You could be pretty far down and away, but it's still the most dominant piece of scenery in the place. So that the Ramban goes out of his way to prove that Har Sinai might mean Midbar Sinai. That Midbar Sinai and Har Sinai were synonyms, and therefore the Torah would have been given to Moshe Rabbeinu perhaps, but taught to Bnei Yisrael only in Midbar Sinai and not afterwards. So this question is resolved by the various Rishonim. We don't have time now for this. The Rambam, the Ramban, I mean, they all think that the Rambam actually is concerned with trying to understand where all this extra Torah came from. You know, like there are minhagim and takanot and siagim, he calls them, all these kinds of additions of the, where in the Gemara it says, oh, chachamim decided that you should do this in order to be protective of the mitzvah. That's a theologically difficult idea, because why would I think that I could improve the Torah? I mean, even if you see that people are falling and they're not actually keeping the Torah properly, but who said that that's what you're supposed to do? We all know that there's a prohibition in the Torah against adding or subtracting. Lo tosif, you're not allowed to add anything to the Torah. Not allowed to add anything to the Torah means that you can't, that's what it means. You can't add to the Torah. So how was it that the Chachamim decided to add all kinds of things, which the Rambam calls again takanot and siyagim? So the Rambam says there's a heter in the Torah to do that. When you see that the Torah is jeopardized, you can try to fix it. That's what the Rambam says. Okay, we talked about, I forgot already what we were talking about. We talked about Lag BaOmer, we talked about Shemitah, we talked a little bit about the Har Sinai.